siren sent from hell. She told me where her room was, and she beckoned me to go. Her body heat washed over me like a steaming lava flow. I should have known that she was making witchcraft.
Advertise your business on Night Dreams Talk Radio, and you will be heard worldwide. Why not contact us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com?
Stay safe, stay indoors, and listen to us.
Coming to you from some far point station, like a cosmic tumbleweed, both north and south of the Pleiades. Here's your host, Gary Anderson.
And that is me. Well, here it is, the 18th of March, and boy, the time is going by so fast. Well, you don't have to worry about filing your taxes this year to May 15th. You gained a little bit there. I hope a lot of you got your checks, because I can guarantee you that will help a lot of people. Well, you know what, James? They said that, there could be alien life on Jupiter, and they're going to find out shortly. Could you imagine if they come back with some type of life form on Jupiter?
Well, that would be something, but my question is, will they admit it, or will it be like maybe we found life form from before, but then they say, well, no, we didn't?
Well, you never know. And you know what? If you're looking to find proof about Bigfoot, Oklahoma is a place you need to go. If you need to make $2 million smackers, you know, $2 million, well, they got a bounty. They'll give you $2 million bucks, 2 million clams, if you can bring back a Bigfoot alive. That would be kind of interesting. No, so far, though, you know, I mean, they might as well as offer $12 million. At this point, nobody's ever captured a Bigfoot.
Oh, that, boy, oh, boy. I got a feeling there's going to be a lot of people in the woods this year, Gary, especially in Oklahoma.
But you know they're going to have to go out and buy, you know what? You know, like bear tags, honey, you know, deer tags to go out hunting. You got to buy Bigfoot tags. So maybe it's going to be self-funding that way.
Yeah, I think that was the whole, it's a money generator. But you know what? I think there's going to be a lot of people out there knocking on trees and howling. And people across the valley hearing it and doing it back thinking there's a Bigfoot.
You know, the bad thing about that is the pranksters. You know, dressing up maybe as a Bigfoot is a good way to get yourself shot because, you know, somebody goes, well, you know what? I bet if they pay me $2 million to bring one back alive, they'll pay me $1 million to bring back one dead. At least somebody out there, you know, would. It is not a good idea. The pranksters seem to come out a lot. And I tell you what, not a good time to do it.
No, it's a good way to get some buckshot in the old bad spot for sure.
Yeah. Well, how is the rain in Ohio?
It was torrential today. The streets was flooding, and we haven't had rain in like 2-3 weeks. It's driest March ever, but then boom, it all came one day.
Yeah. Well, how was it like to walk into your kitchen and take a shower?
Well, that was exactly what you could do today. I walked in there, and it was actually raining in my kitchen. And when they say it rains, it pours, they were not kidding.
Yeah, gee. Well, that's a good way, though. I mean, to... No, it isn't, actually. I just hope you don't have plasterboard falling down here after it starts drying out. I tell you, it must have been really windy then, too, huh?
Yeah, there was 40, 50-mile wind gust. And every once in a while, every year or every other year or so, when we get that kind of wind with that kind of rain, it causes problems on this flat roof. It's just over my kitchen.
Oh, well, you better make sure the next time somebody comes over to take a look and see if you still have that roof there.
Yeah, it
could be down 2 blocks away.
It could be. And it could stay down there 2 blocks away, too, but it could be.
Yeah. Could you imagine in Greenland, they drilled down a mile, and what they found was shocking. They found leaves. They found branches perfectly preserved, saying... And it proves a point. A mile under the ice, they're finding proof that plant life existed, tropical plant life.
Yeah, that is amazing. That's over 5,000 feet deep. That is incredible. My only question is, wonder what other things they may be waking up or unthawing that has been dormant for tens of thousands of years, and now it may not be good for the modern human.
Now, like another virus or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, how about they could dredge up an alien, E.T. or something? You know, think about this. You know, to be a mile thick scares me. A lot of people think, you know, this global warming is a big joke. But seriously, I think I posted up on our show's page on Facebook. Some of the cities on the East Coast, are, when the tide comes in, they're kind of like you could go take a rubber boat or your boat out and go fishing down your street.
Oh, yeah. Some of them are up. You're so correct. Especially, I was on a couple hurricanes in my day. And, boy, I'll tell you what, you did not want to be on the coast on the, you know, on a high tide on a hurricane, on the surge.
Yeah,
sure.
But this is no hurricane. This is just when the tide's coming in, the water is starting to come into some of these towns. And yet we don't do anything to, you know, try to, I don't know. I think it's to the point something's going to happen one of these days. Either we're going to have the magnetic flip, or we're going to go into an ice age, you know, like Whitney and Art Bell, the book, you know, the coming superstorm. And what was that movie they made from it, James?
The Day After Tomorrow. And the part that stunned me was when it got so cold all at once, it like froze people when they took a breath.
Oh, yeah. They became a statue like that. It's scary. People don't realize we're on a cusp of something. Well, in the news, not to even talk about war, but, you know, it's getting interesting. You know, the Russians and the Chinese are accusing our country now of wanting to cause a war. Then we have China wanting to go, they figured the next 6 years to go into, you know, Taiwan. I mean, it's a lot of things going on. You got North Korea. Threatening the United States. They just threatened us again here with about a nuclear missile. And our Secretary of Defense said, hey, try it. You know, we have more capabilities than you do. A lot of things going on all at once, isn't it?
There is. And then you add in these rogue asteroids that keep popping up here and there, and then the magma that's up under Ohio, where I'm at, from the Dakotas and all these other things. Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Why hasn't somebody figured a way to tap into that magma in Ohio and generate heat to generate electricity?
That's a good question. It's been there for millions of years from out there in the central part of the United States, but that's a super volcano just waiting. It's due.
Now, let it go in about 100,000 years ago, but we don't have to worry about it. In a million years from now, you won't have to worry about it because there'll be no oxygen left on our planet.
That's true. We're going to have to, maybe by then, we'll be on that hotel in space, or we'll be transplanted to Mars or somewhere.
Yeah, again, do you really think humans can actually survive on Mars? I mean, with the radiation, everything else? I mean, I don't think so. I really don't think it. You realize the people up in the space station all have health issues when they're done with their assignment. They come back down. They have blood clots. Some of them have come down with cancers. You know, brain activity is, the brain is actually kind of shriveled. Health issues, all kinds of it, just for being up in space. So do you really think we could go live on the moon or live on Mars or Venus or wherever you want to go? Our bodies are built to live on our own planet, not on some other planet.
Right. And, you know, every time we leave this Earth and go in space, the body immediately starts to break down. We're just not meant for it. So that's why when I hear these things, oh, we're going to go to the moon in 2024 or Mars, I'm like, can we even go there today? And are we even capable of it? And do we have people that's even mentally and physically able to withstand it?
I don't think so. By the way, our guest tonight, Ethan Lawrence, we're going to be talking about what it's like to write scripts in Hollywood for sci-fi. He is a major, well, what, a screenwriter, I guess what you call it. Why don't we bring him on here? Well, yeah. Good evening, Ethan. How are you doing, my friend?
Good, Gary. Pleasure to be on Night Dreams Talk Radio with you. How are you doing?
I am doing rather good, other than, you know, I hope I don't live a million years old. I don't want to suffocate.
I don't want to live a million years either. It's too long.
Yeah, I'll live with by 250,000. Anyway, Ethan, what got you into writing screenplays for sci-fi?
Well, as you know, my father, Anthony Lawrence, is a TV writer and feature writer who wrote original Outer Limits and Twilight Zones and created shows like The Sixth Sense, The Phoenix, among many others. And I wanted more than anything when I went to film school at UCLA to kind of distance myself from my dad's career and find something in writing, whether for TV or film, that represented me and not him. You know, he was very successful, so I didn't want to be compared to him. I knew I couldn't really live up to that, even if I wanted to be a writer. So I set out to create a totally different identity for myself. But then after I graduated college, I fell in love with the hit show X-Files and wrote a spec script to give to agents about a person that grew backward, kind of a horror version of Benjamin Button's. And it not only kicked off my career, it completely pigeonholed me in supernatural horror and science fiction for the next 25 years. So much for my distancing from my father. But in the end, it was the best thing that was out there for me. And I've loved it, you know, ever since. It's landed me on a bunch of different kinds of shows that I otherwise would have never had a chance. My first show was called The Pretender. It was all about a guy who could kind of become anything, you know, whether it was a cop or a doctor or a scientist or a pilot. And an agent at ICM at the time had read this spec that I'd done for X-Files and thought it was a good fit for me. I already met on Star Trek Voyager and had an offer from them, which I would have taken in a millisecond, but at that time, you really didn't turn down NBC, CBS, or ABC. So I went with The Pretender, spent a couple of years writing a bunch of episodes for them, and met a ton of writers on their staff that all went on to be big showrunners. And I've worked with many of them over the years. And it was just kind of a door that opened for me in a way that I hadn't really anticipated. And once I started working on shows that were kind of bent towards sci-fi or horror, I realized that that was my sweet spot. It was what I was really good at. And so I just didn't fight it anymore. I embraced, you know, the horror of being just like my father. You know, you can never write an Outer Limits or Twilight Zone. I would never be able to work on shows like that because we just don't have classics like that anymore. But you kind of carve out a similar path with different types of shows. You know, I ended up on, you know, in The Invisible Man on USA Network, a show called Freaky Links that David Goyer had created, a show called So Weird at Disney that was kind of a young version of X-Files. And then ultimately, in that cluster of shows that happened over a few years after The Pretender, was a show called Murder in Small Town X, which was kind of this crazy, ambitious idea to drop 10 real people in a small seaside town populated only by actors portraying characters, and set these 10 people on in kind of an investigation into a decades-old murder mystery that had a bit of a supernatural bent to it. So it sounded good at the time, ended up being kind of a mess, but we shot for 3 months in freezing Eastport, Maine. I gained 20 pounds on lobster rolls, and you know, which was the best part of it. And it ended up being pretty cool and intense, but it kind of solidified me in that genre. The only thing terrible that happened out of that particular show was the guy who won that show, Angel Huarbe, was a fireman, a New York fireman, who 1 week after our show ended, after he had won, died heroically in the collapsing South Tower in Lower Manhattan on 9/11, if you can believe that.
Oh, wow. Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was a crazy, crazy circumstance, and we all were kind of shocked by it. It was the last time I ever worked on anything reality related. I think because of that, I never wanted to go back to it. It was such a twist of fate that I couldn't imagine. But after that, I kind of immersed myself more in kind of more extreme sci-fi. I ended up on Sci-Fi Network's Eureka, which was kind of a comedy mixed with science fiction. I spent 4 years there and had, you know, an incredible time. It's the first time I got to travel a lot to Vancouver and shoot lots of episodes. And Battlestar Galactica was also shooting in the same place, so we got to know their staff and their production really well and hang out with them. We all wanted to be on their show. They all wanted to be on our show. It was kind of a nice family. I still would have wished I had been on that show because Battlestar was a phenomenal show to me, you know, and I grew up on the original as a kid. So I just was obsessed with it. But Eureka did allow me to do some things that were fantastic. I was listening a little bit before I came on about, you know, space and what's happening to our environment. And one of the episodes I did was about the space junk that circles Earth. There's this kind of mechanism called cascade effect where magnetically things shift, and then all of a sudden all that space junk comes, you know, shooting down like missiles on Earth. And so it was kind of my way of discussing the, you know, what was happening to our environment and what we were doing to our planet. And Eureka kind of allowed a lot of episodes to really explore, you know, whether obviously or subtly, what was going on in culture or environment or whatever. And so that was, it was a fun show to be on. And it was sad when it finally went off the air, even though it was a top-rated show, but they just couldn't afford it anymore. It's too much effects, and the actors, you know, were getting too much, so it finally went away. But it was a great time I had there. I really loved it.
You know, I really enjoyed that show, and I do watch reruns on cable. I'm going to take you in a time machine. I'm going to take you back when you were a kid. Now, here your father was writing for Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, and other shows. Were you ever interested as a young kid in the paranormal or sci-fi or monsters and bizarre stuff?
Yeah, I was. My father had such an affinity for it. He even took me to old, you know, Christopher Lee horror films, The House That Dripped Blood and Bela Lugosi movies when I was a little kid because he loved them. My mom didn't, and he wanted to go see them, and I was you know, it was an exciting time to be able to hang with my dad. I was one of five kids, so anytime I got by myself with it was great. But to be able to go see a science fiction or a horror film, which was really the two things he loved most, you know, cinematically. So I loved those movies, and I you know, was obsessed. It's also, I think, that our father being, you know, so prolific in that field, we were exposed to a lot of things supernaturally that we otherwise wouldn't have in terms of literature and TV shows and movies. And I think that that kind of cemented my love of it. I was never scared by it. I still to this day will go see every single horror film, every single sci-fi movie that's out. I live on Netflix watching the most obscure sci-fi you can possibly find, because it's still my kind of fun place to be. It's a, you know, it's escapist, and you know, even at its worst, it's still better than most. So I've always loved it.
You know, I'm kind of weird. I like the old stuff. You know, it was made in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
You know, like the original The Thing with James Arness as the monster.
Love that movie.
Yeah, I really liked it. I didn't like the remake. I liked the original one. And, you know, I think sometimes when they do the remakes, they you know, I guess they want to bring in new graphics. They want to bring in more new content. But sometimes if you have watched the original one, they never do as good as the original.
Yeah, I agree. You know, here's my theory on that, because I could not, you know, agree with you more. I think the original movies were always really a metaphor for humanity and what was really going on in people's lives. And so they used horror as that kind of way of expressing an opinion about that. So there was something raw and real and honest about it. And then when they make remakes, the remakes tend to rely on the effects and the visuals, because those have advanced so much over the years. And every time I've seen it, and I do kind of go see most of these reissues and remakes, and I'm always disappointed. And I always feel like, why'd they remake that? What's the purpose of doing a perfect movie over again? And it's kind of my issue even with Star Wars, the new Star Wars movies. You know, the first one was kind of a remake of, you know, the first Star Wars movie, and you can't improve on that. So if you can't improve on perfection, you might as well just do something new and fresh. So that's kind of my feeling about it.
Well, you know, again, yeah, I like the graphics. I mean, graphics, let's face it, the show Stargate,
yeah,
you know, really created graphics that were fantastic and changed the whole market of making movies and TV shows.
I agree.
And, you know, they were way ahead of their time. But here's the thing. When you go watch, like, The Thing, or you go watch some of the old Outer Limits shows, or you go Twilight Zone, or any of those things, right? You had to use your brain, because they didn't have sophisticated graphics or anything. You could, if you really watch it, you could see the string a lot of times on these UFOs or these zipper on the back of the monster. But you really got into it because the writing was so good. Now,
yeah,
there were some
of
them.
Agree.
There were some of them. Some of the B movies that were really bad. But I mean, yes, a lot of them, it just sucked you into it because, again, the person or the people responsible for the writing of it were so much better. They didn't rely on having to run all these special effects to, you know, hype up the show.
Yeah, I agree. I think that those movies, they had no choice. It's what I loved about Young Frankenstein. I mean, Mel Brooks decided to remake a horror movie, but he did it in black and white. He tried to stay consistent with what those original movies were, while also at the same time making a brilliant comedy out of it. But I think those original movies didn't have a choice. You know, when you think of Frankenstein, you know, the scene where he tosses the girl into the water, it's such a jarring scene. And it's really nothing more than this giant and this little girl, you know, picking a flower. But there's something really disturbing and terrifying about it. My daughter and her best friend wanted to see that movie. And I kept thinking, you know, my dad took me to these horror movies when I was young, and I wanted to expose her to it and see if she liked it. And she loved it. I mean, she thought it was kind of, you know, so unique to anything she had seen before. And every time she sees, in fact, we before the pandemic, we would go over to the New Beverly, Quentin Tarantino's movie theater, because he would play nothing but 1970s and 80s films. And you could see a lot of these kind of original horror films that were just fun to watch. I mean, you know, some of them obviously were more R-rated than you realize because they didn't have a system in place like they do now. But I think that, you know, 40s and 50s got horror right almost in every way. Every movie they made was a classic. Every Dracula movie was a classic. Every Frankenstein, werewolf, every movie just was kind of imprinted on your brain for your entire life. And I don't think movies can capture you in the same way emotionally, because I think they're, you know, as much as I love Marvel movies, they're chock full of so many images which are extraordinary. You can't even remember them by the time they're over with. You know, my daughter loves them, but it's a lot.
Yeah, to go back and describe to somebody one of the current type movies, you know, is so much blood, guts, so much of this, so much of that thrown in there. And it's I think it's too much. Now, going back to the older movies, there's one movie, it's so bad, I still watch it because I get a laugh of it, out of it. It's called The Claw.
Yeah, The Claw. I do remember The Claw.
Yeah, they had a budget, okay? And their budget is, we could have better actors, or we can have better, you know, what do you call it? A better bird or whatever that prehistoric creature was. And they opted for, you know, a little bit, you know, better actors for the show, movie. And I tell you, it's one movie, you watch it, and it's not bad. I get a, you know, I sit back there and I chuckle through it. It's nothing scary, I can tell you that.
No, it's not scary. It was, that actually was released as a double feature with another movie called The Night the World Exploded, which was equally silly. But they were done on this kind of shoestring budget, and it was, you know, like the movie It's Alive. I mean, those movies, they kind of had no choice but to do, you know, the most they could do with these tiny little budgets. But as a kid, I found them really kind of engaging and fun. They were kind of really inoffensive, so you could watch them as a young kid. They weren't scary enough to, you know, persuade my parents to not let me see them. But they were just intense enough for me to feel like I was watching something that I shouldn't be watching. I remember seeing The Exorcist for the first time on a reissue when I was probably 12 or 13. And I went with a couple, I think my two older brothers. And I remember thinking that my brain was absorbing something I had never seen before in my entire life. And my parents would kill me if they knew I was seeing it. But I still remember the way it made me feel that you could be scared that much and still be safe. I thought it was great.
Oh, yeah. You know, there was a movie when I was young, and it was made in the, I would say, mid-50s. But I remember it was on TV, and it was this UFO with these aliens landed next to the city or a small town. And the craft was really small, you know. And but when I was a kid, it was really scary. And then I saw it here about 6 months ago, and I realized this craft was about 8 feet around and maybe 5 feet high. And then, you know, you see him walking in the craft going down the ladder. You know, you know how the budgets were in those movies.
Of course. Yeah. Made no sense whatsoever. But, you know, if you could capture, you know, just that feeling of fear and excitement for kids, which is really what, you know, drew me to wanting to be a writer anyway, is that base feeling that I had when I sat in a movie theater. I mean, I was 12 when Star Wars came out. And I remember thinking my whole life had just changed in 2.5 hours. Like, that's all I wanted to do, was somehow find a way where I could write things that made people feel, you know, excited or scared or intrigued or even confused. It didn't matter. You got to make people feel something. And that's kind of what those movies do. And once you see them as a kid, you almost never forget them, ever.
No, you don't. And unfortunately, when you get my age, you start having dreams of them. I don't know. Hey, Ethan, we need to take a break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. So you're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio. Check out our website at www.nightdreamstalkradio.com. We got a ton of books out there from a lot of our guests. You know, you can check out their books. You click on to it. It'll take you to Amazon where you can purchase it. You know, support them and support our show. By the way, you can become a night dreamer. Just go to our website and hit that little envelope on the right side. Give me your name, the country you're in, and we'll set it all up. We'll be right back. You're listening to me, Gary, on Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Do you have a paranormal story you want to share on Night Dreams Talk Radio? You could be a guest. Email us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com.
We're here to make you. Hi, Tom Davis here with Metatron Power and Light. We'd like to thank everyone for all the positive emails and responses to our music. Our music can be found on Amazon, Spotify, YouTube, and all digital outlets, and is featured on Night Dreams Talk Radio with Gary Anderson.
Metatron Power and Light is a band that deals with esoteric subjects, the paranormal, and other topics that engage the spirit and mind. Visit MetatronPowerAndLight.com to learn more.
We are facing a time of great change, and the future is unwritten. But when we come together and seek answers, we expand our awareness until we begin to see the unseen. Uncovering secrets allows us to develop the knowledge we will need to shape our future and control our destiny.
Night Dreams Talk Radio, After Dark, wants to give a big shout out to all the truckers that listen to our show.
From the compound in beautiful Gig Harbor, Washington, Night Dreams Talk Radio presents your host, Gary Anderson.
And we are back. Our guest tonight is Ethan Lawrence. He writes really great screenplays. If you're into the sci-fi, you might recognize his name. I got to ask you a question, Ethan. If you're writing for a... This is a good question for somebody out there who wants to become a screenwriter or write, you know, stories. If you're writing for a particular TV show, for example... And they, what's all involved? I mean, how do you come up with ideas for the next episode?
For the most part, you know, there is what's called a writer's room. They, you know, the showrunner, who's kind of the boss, he's, you know, he or she's the lead writer on the show. They create this kind of office space, which, of course, nobody's doing that now due to the pandemic, but eventually we'll get back to that template. But you're all basically 10 or 11 of us sit in a room, and we kind of work out the full season usually of the show. With Eureka, that's kind of how it worked out. One of the reasons I was brought in is they were looking to kind of bring in new writers who could kind of come up with a full season of shows that they hadn't really done yet in the first season. So you're kind of working out big ideas first. You know, what's the full season? Where do we want to go maybe over the next 3 or 4 years? And then you start kind of talking about the specifics of what is the first episode going to be about, you know, what's the second episode. And as you start to break that down, depending upon your kind of your participation and maybe your even your passion for a particular idea, or maybe you came to the table with an idea, which is usually what happened to me when I did the space junk idea. I just came in and said, look, we should do a space junk idea. It's, you know, it's all over the news. I just read this great article about it. I showed them, they loved the idea. They slotted me in like the third episode of that season. And you know, so I always knew that was my episode. But typically, the showrunner kind of, you know, lets the development of that season kind of dictate who gets what episode. And then once you've kind of been picked for that episode, when we arrive at that episode, we do what's called break the show, or break the episode is, you know, all of us kind of tag team together on ideas, throwing things around, trying to figure out what's the best approach to that episode. How do we break it down? You know, back in the olden days when I first started, we were breaking everything into 4 or 5 acts. Now, pretty much it's, you know, even in regular TV, they're still doing it, but they mostly just break them like a streaming episode where it's just, you know, 52 minutes of straight drama. And then once your story is kind of broken and everyone feels good about it, you know, the writer's given the task of writing the outline for it, that's submitted to the showrunner, then ultimately to the studio and the network. Once approval happens from all of them, which usually happens fairly quickly because they're always on time constraints, then you go off and you write that episode. On Eureka, for me, and this happened to me a lot, I don't know why, but it always seemed to be the case, I always got about 3 or 4 days to write an episode because they were really rushed for time. Typically, they give you a couple of weeks so that you have time to really put it together. But sometimes if the development process takes too long, they have no choice but to kind of rush the script. So the, you know, the scripts are written by that writer And then sometimes the showrunner will do a little polish on character, and then it goes into the studio again in the network, and that's it. And then they shoot the episode. You know, for Eureka, it was in Vancouver. For Pretender, it was in Woodland Hills. It depends on where production is. But that's usually the process of every single show.
Interesting. How about where do you ever have them sent back and say, hey, we need you to revise this a little bit?
Every single time. Unfortunately, Gary. But usually you have to kind of trust the executives. I always trusted the executives at studios because they were already creative types. Networks tended to be more kind of bean counters. And so we didn't really love their ideas. And so, you know, it was up to the showrunner to decide what you as the writer should address and what you should just ignore and move on, because there's no way they're ever going to read that script twice. And they never did. So I was always kind of, I deferred to them to tell me whether I needed to do more. Typically, they're easily addressed notes. You know, they have to do with character expansions and plot twists and confusion here and a word here, line there. But every once in a while, they blow up your episode. They'll just say, you know what, nothing about this is working, and we want to go back to square one. That's the worst phone call for any writer. You hope that doesn't happen. It's only happened a few times in my life. I felt really bad about it, but you know, you kind of have the support of the show and everybody on it that it's not your fault. We all broke it together. We just got to go back and give it another try. And usually it all works out fine. And there's only so much time. So they can't, you know, they can't make you spend forever on these episodes. You know, movies are different. You know, you have, if you write it by spec, you have as much time as you want. And if you're hired, you're given many months to kind of work out a screenplay. So you have lots of time to kind of spend and think and research and kind of mull it over. TV is a very fast-paced medium that you don't have a lot of time. So I think the big criteria for writers getting into the business, and it was for me and my wife, who's also a writer, is you have to be able to write fast and you have to write shootable scripts. So when you're done, they have to believe that this could actually be shot. Even if it has some work to be done, they have to know that. So that's a big deal.
Well, where do you get your material? Does it just pop in your head or what? I mean, to sit there and write a script in 3 days, for example, for a shoot, I mean, that is horrible. I know some shows only have, like, what, 4 or 5 days to do the shoot anyway.
Yep.
But to sit here and come up with the idea and write the script, and that, I mean, how do you do it?
Well, it's, you know, each case is different because some shows, I tend to be very prepared. And I learned that from my father, who was a big advocate about, do your research, be prepared, know what you're going to say. Don't go in and try and make things up as you go along. And so I kind of took that to heart very early on. My mother was, you know, a really good research person for my dad as well. And so I kind of learned from them that I just needed to have ideas already ready to go. They weren't all going to sell and they weren't all going to be good. But usually if I went in on a show, and this goes for almost any show I've ever been staffed on, is I always came in with 10 ideas I thought I could pitch, and usually 2 of them they loved, and the rest they wanted me to burn immediately. But I got 2, you know, past them, and you know, when you have an idea that you like, which is the other thing, that you feel passionate about, and it's not just something handed to you by another writer, I think you tend to put your all into it. You tend to understand the material, particularly for Eureka. I was a big, huge kind of, you know, fan, some might call it fanatic, about anything space related. So I really wanted to do episodes about space. I felt like I had a knowledge of space. I had a knowledge of, you know, things that were both tragic and wondrous in outer space. And so I thought I could use that skill set to both pitch and convince them that I could pull it off very quickly. And usually that works. Horror is kind of the same for me too. I got that from my dad. I know not only a ton about what scares you, but I also know the history of horror and what's supernatural and the legacy of horror and where so many different horror tales come from. I have volumes and volumes in my office of it. And when I think you understand the material, I think it gives you an edge to kind of be prepared to write quickly and hopefully effectively. Doesn't always work, but you give it your best shot. And you know, there's a support network within every show that they all want you to succeed, because, you know, it's their you know, show as well as yours. And so sometimes, you know, and this happened to me a number of times where a writer just said, hey, do you mind writing an act for me? Because I just feel like I can't get this done. And I'm not sure if, you know, if I'm ready for this, you know, material. And so everyone kind of tag teams. And I've had the, you know, the good fortune of having people jump on mine as well, just to kind of make it just right. So it's both being just kind of familiar with the material and really just being passionate about it.
Well, here you said your wife is a writer too. What does she write?
My wife is actually running right now, which is a huge task. She's running two different shows. She's running a show on CBS called All Rise, which is a kind of a judge lawyer kind of show, heavy drama, and which is what her strength is. She loves that. She's also running a show for the OWN network called David McMahon, which is all just kind of really very, really heavy, dark, you know, coming of age drama. So that's kind of her strong suit. It's, you know, it's what she loves to do. We were originally going to try and write together. We both met in college. And while I was in film school, she was a math major and or a computer science major, actually. And she was getting offers from, you know, Northrop to go work for them and build weapons. And she just realized that she didn't want to do it. And I was like, what do you want to do? And she goes, well, I want to be a writer like you. And I thought, you know, it's not that easy. And it turned out it was that easy. She just started educating herself. Turned out she had a lot of talent. And she followed, you know, her path the way I did mine. She didn't try and veer from it. She went down, you know, and really studied the very kinds of things she wanted to write, which was, you know, drama and personal stories. And it's served her extremely well over the years. You know, she's got... she's actually under contract to Warner Brothers right now. And so she's enjoying the fruits of many years of hard work and getting many opportunities to kind of do shows that she wants to do and her own shows, hopefully down the road. So, you know, I've always told, and I go up to UCLA and I teach, you know, every once in a while for old professors. And I always tell writers in writing classes the same thing. You know, you have to find something that makes you feel more than just, I want to make a good living and I want to make money, because there are just too many people out there that their passion for writing is so strong that they will just take all the jobs from you. You've just got to find whatever it is that you think you can do better than anybody else and make that your agenda and keep working hard at that. I learned very quickly that, you know, horror and sci-fi was not only something that was enjoyable to me, but it could be fruitful. Because I knew it very well and I enjoyed it. And there weren't a lot of people out there that were doing it the way I was doing it or even wanted to do it. So, you know, my wife kind of did the same thing, and we've been fortunate enough to keep, you know, keep going.
Oh, wow. Now, while you guys are in bed sleeping at night, are you guys talking out loud in your sleep about a screenplay you're working on? Do you ever have that?
We do a lot. In fact, you know, early on, we read virtually every script that the other one wrote and gave notes. And we were very, you know, kind of supportive in that way. But because there's so many things going on, and I ultimately, you know, after Eureka, you know, I got hired to write Hellraiser 5. And I wrote a movie called Asylum that, you know, did very well and particularly well overseas. And so I kind of got into writing more kind of direct horror, which was not something she cared to read because she hates horror. And I just didn't have the time to read the enormous amount of scripts that she was writing on shows. So we stopped kind of being able to read each other's material, but we always talk about what, you know, what we're working on and what, if there's some block in terms of mentally getting something right or what we're trying to work on. My wife is actually next week going to direct her very first episode. And it's kind of her moving into a new arena that she's never been in before. And we talk a lot about, you know, how to create shots and, you know, and how to, you know where the actors should be and what you want from the actors. And we talk a lot about that kind of stuff. And within that framework, that support is really invaluable to both of us, because, you know, nobody's going to ever defend you and protect you more than your spouse, hopefully. So it's been good. It's been good over the years that we share. Most people think that we're going to kill each other being in the same field, but we've managed to stay away from each other being on the same show and just, you know, do different things that we feel passionate about. And that's worked well for us.
Of all the shows you wrote for, what was your favorite, and what episode was it?
That's a good question. I think that I would probably have to say Pretender, and the reason I say that is I got to write an episode that sounded insane at the time, but they loved it, the showrunners, and it was the first time I was given kind of carte blanche to be on a set and to interact with actors, and I was a staff writer at that point, which meant I was just a baby beginner writer, and they never got a chance to be on sets. But these particular showrunners saw something in me at that time and liked, you know, my attitude and liked the way I wrote and liked that particular episode and were willing to give me a chance. And it was really just a ripoff of I'm drawing a total blank right now. It's a ripoff of Reservoir Dogs. And it was really just about, I mean, if you remember the show, the guy could be anything. And so in that particular episode, he kind of joins this band of thieves, and he convinces them that they've all been poisoned by a deadly virus in order to weed out a killer. And what you don't know is that the FBI is basically behind fake walls, and it's all just a huge setup, which is what the show always was. It was this guy who kind of grew up in a lab and had these brilliant skill sets that he could use against normal people, and he always outwitted them in amazing, unique ways. And I remember in that particular episode, I got to kind of get all these characters, these actors, to portray themselves as going insane. And while I was on the set, I just was kind of in awe that I wrote something that people were saying, and I was witnessing it, and I was having the time of my life, and I was getting paid to do it, because it was either write for a living or be a dishwasher at a lousy restaurant. So those are my choices at that point. So I was grateful for anything, but particularly that I love these showrunners. I'll even call them out, Craig Van Sickle and Steve Wellen. They were – Wellen Mitchell. They went – above and beyond for me in the very beginning, where I could have just been, you know, one and out writer. They gave me 8 episodes and 2 seasons to write as much as I wanted to, and let me sit on the set and learn and absorb. And I think had that not happened, had I not gone with those two in the very beginning, who knows how things would have worked out for me. So I'm grateful.
Oh, wow. Now, Truth or Dare. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Truth or Dare is a movie that I recently wrote. My wife says that it's me at my most perverse. And I think that the reason for that is what I was trying to do is find a way to kind of delve into the in the last year, we've heard lots of lies, and everybody's disagreeing and agreeing about whether lies are told or aren't told. And I kind of wanted to explore through this, you know, this game concept of truth or dare, you know, about whether people's lies catch up to them and whether you're punished in the end. So it was really about a group of college kids who head to this haunted rental in a remote area for kind of a fun weekend. And they engage in this game of truth or dare. You know, they're not young anymore. So the truth or dare isn't that kind of fun game. They're just doing it to kind of keep busy. But ultimately the game threatens them because as they begin to refuse these increasingly challenging tasks, they're met with this kind of deadly consequences, quickly discovering that you must do the dare or the dare does you. And it all kind of comes back to the secrets and lies that all these people have been holding on to from their friends and from themselves. And but to be honest, I kind of went as far as I could with how people treat each other, and that got both kind of violent and both disturbing in the nature of characters. And it was a fun script to write, and it's done so well on Netflix, which was kind of exciting for me that Netflix reached out to me and the producer and asked us to do something similar for them. So I'm working on a new movie for them that's about Spin the Bottle. It's kind of a take on that movie that has a lot to do with what's been going on virally on our planet and what it all means to our future. So the movie was a great opportunity for me to kind of open the door to Netflix and streamers in general. And it was a fun movie to write, but even more fun to shoot. Everybody put their heart and soul into it, as most people do. And movies are different than TV because, you know, in TV, you're one of many. And in movies, while you're one of many, you're only one of one writer. And so all roads lead to you when it comes to whether the movie does well or does terribly. And so you give your best that you can, just so that you have a chance that the movie can get a release. And Truth or Dare was, you know, something I had no idea whether it would be seen or not seen. And it did get seen, and it did well. It did great overseas. And then Netflix picked it up, and it was at the top of their queue for a long time. And I didn't know that. My daughter actually saw it and said, "Hey, Dad, your movie's, you know, the number one movie on Netflix this week." And I was like, "Oh, shut up. There's no way." And she was right. It was brief, but I'll take it. It was very brief. But, you know, in the end, it's still really just about trying to find something that's – horror is like sci-fi to me. It's got to be relatable. It's got to teach you something about humanity. And it has to make you feel like, you know, you've learned something about something without maybe being too preachy about it. And that can be fun.
Why do you think that the movies being made and TV shows have to show so much blood and guts nowadays?
That's a great question. And I think that, and I'll speak to that directly about Truth or Dare and Asylum. Truth or Dare, the script was not bloody at all. I mean, it was about, you know, people having to do terrible things to each other in order to kind of peel away the onions to their lies and deceit. But the way I wanted to do it was more in the vein of, you know, classic horror films that showed things more in shadow and inferred things without it being, you know, a bloodfest. But in the end, I lost that fight, you know, with the studio, because they feel that two things. One is overseas, blood sells and action sells, and those kinds of things are important to them. But they also feel that that there is something viscerally more terrifying what you see than what you feel. I don't agree, but most studios do. And so you fight that fight, and you try and find a way to make it scary without being terrible. I mean, the ending of that movie, not to give too much away for your audience, but, you know, it comes down to these two, you know, women who are best friends, and they have to basically survive by doing terrible things to each other. But it was done in a very stylized way on my script. It became a bit more graphic for the movie, and that wasn't something I had control over. But I you know, made it known that I think that you're losing the real terror. You know, there's a big difference. It's a gulf of difference between terror and violence, and you have to kind of find a way to make an audience feel terrorized watching something, but not feel grossed out. So sometimes you win these battles. My father was, I thought, brilliant at that when he was doing Outer Limits, and even things early on, like a show called Sixth Sense. They didn't have a budget for graphic effects, so everything was done in this kind of almost ephemeral way, and you felt absolutely disturbed by it. And I wish that we would go back to that.
Well, you know, some of the best shows, you know, like you go Outer Limits or Twilight Zone. Again, yeah, they had no budget, you know, for special effects, but that's where your brain came in. Maybe,
right.
Maybe a lot of people who watched The Twilight Zone when it originally was being broadcast remembered. They're at the age where they remember sitting in their living room, you know, listening to War of the Worlds, Amos and Andy on the radio,
right,
where you had to use your brains, you know, to put all the things together.
Yeah, it's such a different thing. I mean, I remember my father, he wrote, this was unrelated to genre, but I guess it is a bit genre. He wrote a two-part episode for a series called Swiss Family Robinson, and it was all about Jean Lafitte and the pirates coming to the island. It was a big, huge two-parter, and it was really cool. But there were no pirate ships. They weren't allowed to carry swords. There was no fighting. And I remember my father at that time being furious, because he's like, you know, what kind of a pirate doesn't have a ship, a sword, and can't fight? It's not even a pirate. So I remember even as a young kid thinking that there are great restrictions non-creative people giving to creative people, and you have to work within those constraints. And so I said this to my wife when it came to her directing, is, you know, when you write a script, you find a way to put in there how you see this visually. And I always try and do that with scripts. And I suggest that every writer does this, is visualize that scene, not just put in, okay, they walk into the door and then they have a conversation. Try and visualize in a just a moment, a word here or a sentence here, so that the director understands how you want to see that scene, because sometimes it can have dramatic effect that's either unintended or it's completely intended. But I think it's better for writers to have that control, because ultimately a director or a studio exec is going to go in their own direction. And so, you know, which is why my dad always said, you know, be a director as well as a writer, because somebody's going to interpret your writing. And he's right. They do all the time. Sometimes they do a better job than you. Sometimes they don't.
Oh, yeah. Boy, you know, the time went by so fast, and I have so much more questions. Ethan,
this is great.
Is there a way, do you have a website where people can find out more information about what you're doing, or blog or anything?
Like most writers, I don't have a website. But I do have, people can reach out to me directly via my email, which is fine. You know, I answer, you know, tons of questions from students at UCLA all the time about how they feel about things. I'm kind of, my daughter actually just told me before I went on with you that you need to set up a separate, you know, work Instagram, and you need to set up a separate Facebook and a separate, you know, website. So I'm working on that. I'm not as good as my brother Fireball Tim is, who's a genius at all that stuff.
Oh, yes, he is. I have to admit, he was he was on my show a couple of weeks ago, and I tell you,
right,
interesting person. I tell you, I didn't realize he designed so many cars like he does. But
oh, it's incredible. Yeah, he's done thousands of different things. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, hey, we'll have to get you back on sometime and go a little bit more. Because you know what? There's a lot of people who are emailing me, hey, maybe I can learn how to be a screenwriter. What's it take? So maybe we can have a part two on all that.
That'd be wonderful. Whatever works in whatever time, Gary, this was great. I really enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
Okay, my friend. Well, you have a great weekend. It's coming up. And say hi to your wife and daughter. Your daughter's right. You need to get a website. And you need to get, on Twitter.
I'm going to work on that, I promise.
Okay. You take care, my friend.
Thanks, Gary. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Well, hey, James, who's our guest tomorrow? What are we going to be talking about tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow night, our guest, we have two guests, the twins, Ronald and Philip Kinsella, and they're going to be talking about abductions, UFOs, and their whole research and intake and their views on what they found.
Yeah, and they kind of feel the same way that I kind of feel, that not all ETs give us orb and love, do they?
No, not at all, and they have their own agendas.
Yeah, yeah, like, what's for dinner?
Right,
yeah,
right.
So what are you going to do about your roof leaking, my friend?
Well, quote right in, so... So I don't know. I got some sealant and stuff to temporarily put a Band-Aid on a bullet hole, I guess, patch it up, so to speak.
Now, as long as you don't fall through the ceiling.
Yeah, no, I don't plan on getting on that flat roof anytime soon. But, yeah, or the ceiling falling in, right, either one.
Yeah. I remember when I was a young kid, my grandmother and my grandfather had a house, and it started leaking. And I think it was in the dining room or kitchen. I can't remember where. But, you know, after the leak stopped about 3 weeks later, you know, big hunch of, you know, ceiling was on the floor.
Yeah, that tends to happen because you get the weight of the water and it soaks in if it's like a plaster type.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could all go south real quick.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, well, I can't wait tomorrow to have the Kinsella brothers on. It's going to be a good show. Every time they're on, everybody just loves it. And, you know, tonight... Ethan Lawrence, we learned a lot, seriously, about what it takes to write a screenplay for a TV show. Again, I didn't realize they only had 3 to 4 or 5 days or less to write a screenplay for a TV show versus, you know, a long time for a movie. You know, the pressure that would be like, James, to, you know, oh, you got to have the script done by Thursday. We're shooting Friday.
Yeah. Right, and it's got to be has some quality to it. But I've seen both them movies he wrote too. That one movie, Truth or Dare, I'll tell you, that's a movie to watch. That really gets you.
Yeah, and you can find it on Netflix.
Yeah, I seen it on TV not too long ago.
Yeah. Well, till tomorrow, everybody, you have a good one. And again, I want to thank Ethan Lawrence and his father. And I want to do a special shout out to Fireball, because without Fireball, we wouldn't have had Ethan on. So I tell you, very talented family. We'll be back tomorrow. Everybody, have a good one. And tomorrow we'll be back on for maybe even more than 2 hours.